Hello and welcome to episode 113 of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum here at Camp Shelby. And with me, as always, is my esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Toedy, former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine USS Indianapolis, Commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, and many other postings. Bill, how are you this afternoon?
Doing great. Looking forward to our special guest today.
Excellent. And speaking of special guests, aside from Bill and I, we're happy to welcome a special guest for this week's episode, Dave Holland. Dave is a former United States Marine. He owns and runs the Facebook and YouTube channel called Guadalcanal Walking a Battlefield. He's a Solomon Islands battlefield guide, and most importantly, a Guadalcanal expert, hence the reason he is here. Bill and I are very happy to welcome Dave to our show. Dave, welcome, and how are you doing, man?
I'm doing well, and thanks again for letting me come on your show. It's an honor and a pleasure, and I'm just excited to talk about Guadalcanal with you guys.
Hey, Dave, before we jump into this, last time we exchanged notes, I mentioned that your wonderful YouTube site and, mm-hmm. and Facebook page and all of that, but I said I was confused by your accent. Do you remember what you told me about that?
Oh, I don't, can't remember, but...
You said it was a mixture of Australia and somewhere in the U.S.
Oh yeah, Alabama.
Alabama.
Yeah, I had one person one time tell me on a comment. He says, "I don't know if you're either from Alabama or Adelaide, so you couldn't work it out."
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a hybrid mixed bastard accent, I call it. But yeah.
And what years were you in the U.S. in the Marines?
From 85 to 93.
Okay. Yeah. Great.
I was born and raised in the States, but yeah, I went in when I was 18. Mm-hmm. Got out when I was 26 and came to Australia in 95. And I've been here in 28 years now.
Wow, exactly. Yeah, well, welcome again and Semper Fi.
Yeah, you too, sir.
All right. So in our last episode, Bill and I set up Operation Watchtower, which of course is what Guadalcanal, no, it is Guadalcanal, and Tulagi and Tanambogo and Gavutu and everything else. But our main focus is Guadalcanal. That being said, we've covered everything, the lead up, blow by blow, step by step. And our calendar now is set for August 7th, 1942. The transports are offshore. The Marines are loaded in the landing craft and are headed to the beaches of Tulagi and Guadalcanal. The proverbial die has been cast and the campaign, for better or worse, is on. So, Dave, let's enlighten us on the H-hour on Guadalcanal. American intel assumed that the bulk of the Japanese were on Guadalcanal, specifically along Lunga Point. You know, the estimates were relatively high in terms of Japanese on the island, were they not?
Oh, yes. That was the intelligence that they had picked up. The Marine intelligence actually estimated there was a whole Japanese infantry regiment on Guadalcanal, and also Japanese engineers or pioneers, as Vandegrift had called them, which is the equivalent of the combat engineers. In reality, they were actually construction troops, Koreans. And also, they knew there was a contingent of Japanese on Tulagi, Gavutu, and Tanambogo due to the seaplane base there. And they knew there was some Japanese special naval landing force. But yeah, they vastly overestimated the number.
So as far as, you know, and we're going to get to Tulagi in just a second, but we'll talk about Guadalcanal, the landing on Guadalcanal. You know, I knew some of the guys who were slated to come in later on. They were in the 1st Marines, H Company, 2nd Battalion, 1st. You'll hear about them later when we talk about Tinaroo River. But Sid Phillips, in particular, was telling me that, you know, he was told before they were to land, that they were to expect, you know, heavy defensive fire, that, you know, they'd be lucky if they got off the landing craft alive, and heavy casualties were expected. And that is not what happened at all, is it?
No, that's not what happened. I've got a letter from Vandegrift, who was division commander to Holcomb, who was the commandant of the Marine Corps at the time, and he wrote it on the 11th of August. So it's a few letters they used to exchange, personal letters, and I have a few of those. Mm-hmm. And I have one after Alligator Creek, which is, when we get to that point, it's quite interesting. But he mentions there's two reasons why they landed on Beach Red and not directly on Lunga Point, which was the point directly at the airfield. Mm-hmm. He said the first main reason was we were going to land where the Japanese were not. So they didn't expect any heavy resistance on the beach from the command level. And then number two reason They wanted to land there to serve as an envelopment to try to cut the Japanese off from fleeing to the hills. Because if they hit them dead on, they were thinking the Japanese would retrograde back into the hills behind. And once they got into those hills, it'd be hard to dig them out. Because you got to remember, just like I said, they were expecting a whole reinforced infantry regiment who would fight. And they knew from reconnaissance from the coast watchers and the air reconnaissance from the B-17s that the Japanese had some defensives there. It turned out to be their defensive positions around Lunga Point were mainly in the anti-aircraft role. They did have some machine guns and positions set up, but no heavy defenses. Now, getting back to what probably Sid Phillips and a lot of the privates and the young enlisted Marines were told, they were probably just revving them up to get them in the right mindset to say, look, you're going into combat. It's a good chance you're going to get killed and wounded, and you're going to hit the beach and probably to get them fired up for the fight. But at the command level, they weren't expecting a fight there. But if you go to Beach Red, or Red Beach as it's called today, it's in concave. It's about 1,700 yards long, which actually longer than when it's extended. But the actual beach here was about 1,600 yards long. They were going to hit that beach. They wanted to extend it to offload the further supplies, but it's in a concave position and it's enfiladed from the side. So if the Japanese really wanted to hold that beach, it would have been pretty hard for the Marines because it would have been hit enfiladed left and right. But that's the main reason.
Did we know when we landed that there were a lot of Korean slave, airfield builders there? Or did we assume that everybody on the ground was a Japanese soldier?
No, they knew there was some construction troops building that airfield because it was become quite large, and they had a large establishment set up there with power plants and buildings, and they'd built them three or four piers at Kukum. So they knew there was a large contingent of Japanese engineers there. And I don't know if the naval intelligence had actually picked up the individual units, but it was two construction battalions. It was the 11th and the 13th Naval Construction Battalions. And they were commanded by captains. And the Navy captains, I don't think it was what Japanese Navy captain rank was, but it was probably around 2,000 of those guys, probably 1,000 in each battalion. They were mainly Korean laborers and some Formosan laborers or Taiwanese laborers, so to speak, nowadays. So yeah, they knew they were there, but they had a small guard company of Special Naval Landing Force, probably around 200, maybe 300 of those guys. And that was the only infantry or ground combat troops they had, and they called it the guard company.
Let's talk about Tulagi. Now, where Guadalcanal was, easy cakewalk landing, Tulagi, and there really wasn't a whole lot of combat in the first couple of days on Guadalcanal. I know there were some scattershot firefights here and there, but Tulagi, Gavutu, and Tanambogo were not like that at all, were they?
No, and the Marines expected a hard fight. They knew, once again, from the intelligence and their reconnaissance, and the Japanese had landed on Tulagi in May. There was one branch during the battle when they were going to hit Port Moresby that led to the Battle of Coral Sea, as you probably discussed in earlier, that one branch shot off and secured Tulagi, which had a small contingent of Australians on Gavutu and Tanambogo, and they had four Catalinas. So they left very quickly. And Tulagi was the pre-war capital of the British Solomon Islands. So he had his residency there. It was established what you think a colonial outpost would be. It had its golf course and had very meticulous golf courses, and it had its country clubs, and it had its colonial governor. Very nice place to live, actually. So they knew the Japanese had landed there, and they knew the Japanese had established a large float plane base. I forgot the number of planes, was a large amount of them. Mm-hmm. They also knew that the 3rd Kuri Japanese Special Naval Landing Force was there, and it estimated it was roughly over 1,000 in that area. And they knew it would be a hard fight because a very small island, especially, even Tulagi is a small island. It was the largest of the three. So they expected a hard fight. So expecting that, Vandegrift took his best units he had, at the time. He rated it his best units, which was the 1st Raider Battalion, the 2nd Battalion of the 5th Marines, mm-hmm. which I don't know if some of you listeners would know that the 1st Battalion of the 5th Marines morphed into the 1st Raider Battalion or the 1st Special Battalion. Mm-hmm. And Edson, Colonel Edson, the commander of 1st Raiders, was 1-5. So they knew a lot of the guys in 2-5, and they worked well with those guys. And he had Rosecrans, which was a battalion commander. He was a very switched on battalion commander. But then he had the 1st Parachute Battalion. Mm-hmm. It was a battalion, I think, roughly about 400 guys. And they were highly trained and highly elite Marines, especially mm-hmm. a lot of the NCOs. Because they got the peak of the crop. And then he had the 2nd Marine Regiment, which is a unique story in itself. The 2nd Marine Regiment was the reserve. Mm-hmm. And they were assigned to that task force going to Tulagi. But they were going to basically be there. And at the end of the day, then they were going to send them back to Santa Cruz to take Nandini to Santa Cruz Island, which Vandegrift didn't want to do it, but the Turner, the amphibious commander, did.
So initially, when they landed, when the Raiders landed, or when everybody landed in Gavutu and Tanambuga, on Tulagi, the resistance was similar to what it was on Guadalcanal. There wasn't a whole lot of beach resistance, if I'm not mistaken. But it's when they started to move into the island a little bit more is when they started to really run into some rather stiff resistance. Isn't that right, Dave?
Yeah, so we're talking about Tulagi now. Tulagi, initially, the way Tulagi set up, the only appropriate landing beaches for common doctrine is down on the southeast corner. But the southeast corner has a large hill called 281, which is designated by the Marines, and it's straight up. And it has a lot of good defensive positions on it. So if the groups were going to land at that place that the Japanese expected, the only place you could probably land, according to normal doctrine, they would be subject to some heavy fire. Mm-hmm. So Pertus, which was the Brigadier General, the Assistant Division Commander, with his planners, spoke to a couple of Australians that had his guides. There's some Australians who lived there on the islands. One was named Spencer, and I have his memoir. It's a great memoir. He became a flight officer, and he was the guide. He guided the Marines in because he'd lived on the island, I think, for like 10 years. So he knew the area. And he advised them. He said, look, on the north west side, there's coral. He said, if you don't care about your boats getting smashed, you can land there and wade in. And the Marine says, okay, we'll take that risk. Thus, we'll hit them where, same as Vandegrift said with Red Beach, we'll hit them where they don't expect us to be. So they did. They landed there. And once again, it was very correct to hit the coral. And none of the beaches landed on the, or sorry, none of the boats landed on the beaches. They had to jump out. Some of them jumped out 100 yards out.
Just like Tarawa.
Yeah, but luckily they were unopposed and they moved their way in. And when the first guys moved in, the Raiders were going to go and take a right turn. And there's a big ridge. It runs straight down the middle of the island. So they're going to run down the ridge, separate, and kind of move on line with first two companies and two companies behind them. Then after the Raiders had landed, the second time, the 5th Marines going to land behind them and take a left turn and clear out the northern end of the islands. And it wasn't until probably 2-3 hours in, they had cleared most of the island. The Raiders had moved down until they got to an area called Hill 208. And that was the area where the colonial police superintendent's house was and the police barracks. And it comes into one of my favorite Guadalcanal individual, so to speak, Ken Bailey. I guess when the Battle of Bloody Ridge, Redson Ridge, you'll know more about Ken Bailey. But Ken Bailey was a major, and he was the company commander of C Company. And there was his task moving on the right-hand side. And when they would pass Hill 208 on the beach side front, when they got their backs to it, the Japanese had a couple of machine gun posts on the beach side. So his company started taking fire from the rear left, and they reacted, obviously. And at one stage, Bailey, they'd found the Japanese bunker, and he's on top of the bunker, and he's ripping the sandbags and ripping the logs off, trying to get in, and he's taking a shot into his leg. But him and a couple of other Marines ended up taking out that Japanese bunker. So he was wounded right then. And Bailey was a big fella too. He's like 6'3 or 6'4, and he's a larger than life character. Nice. So that was the first resistance they had. Then I think B Company started getting a bit of resistance at the Chinese village, they called it, on the left hand side. And then they started getting more and more resistance. But the main Japanese resistance was in 281. That was their main strong point. They built all their defenses around Hill 281, which is in the very southern tip of the island. It's a big hill.
Yeah,
and the island it had caves, and what you'd expect Japanese in defensive positions later on would be in a war.
And that's something that I think is very important, is that this, you know, as the Marines were pushing the Japanese down the island, and it's only like 2.5 miles long or something like that, or
yeah, it's colliding. about 4,000 yards long, about 1,000 yards wide.
As the Japanese are being pushed further and further and further down, they like you said, they get up in the caves and they start holding up in these caves. And this is exactly what happens to, you know, wherever there was a Pacific island with caves, be it Peleliu or Okinawa or Saipan or and on and on and on and on and on. This was their tactic, you know, and this is the first time we'd run into this in the Pacific theater, is right here on Tulagi. And it's just a harbinger of things to come for the rest of the war. And there were some unique ways that the Marines and the Raiders were getting these people out of these caves. Can you expound on some of that information there for us, Dave?
Oh, yeah. Just like you said, this set the stage for the rest of the Pacific War. So they didn't have in the later what they called the blowtorch and corkscrew techniques. They eventuated later how to take out caves and bunkers with the flamethrowers and the demo charges and bazookas, because they didn't have any of that. They had the demolition charges. Mm-hmm. That was it. There's no flamethrowers. They only had the marine ingenuity, the bravery, and hand grenades and demolition charges. They had a gunnery sergeant named Angus Goss, and he was the demo specialist for 1st Raider Battalion. He trained a number of the raiders in demolition. Some of the techniques that he was employing there and the other Marines, they were taking, they're basically, I wouldn't say abseiling, or they call it repel, or I'm almost straying there, repelling. They call it abseiling in Australia, but using ropes, going down off the cliffs, and they were taking the satchel charges or the TNT blocks, and they're putting them on pieces of board with long sticks. Mm-hmm. And they were loading them over the caves and they're trying to blast the caves, or they would put a satchel charge on a rope and just swing it into the cave, and hopefully it would explode. Mm-hmm. And some of the ways they were getting down was on ropes, and they were rappelling themselves down and throwing them in these caves. That and the grenades. And at one stage, there's a place on Tulagi called the Cutting. The Cutting is a pre-war cutting, so it's a great place to see if you ever visit there. So they cut it in the 1920s. They cut a small road through the main ridge to get from one side of the island to the other. So the Japanese had a cave entrance in there, and there was a number of Japanese inside there, and the Marines couldn't get them out, because every time the Japanese come out, the Marines were on both sides of a cutting. Just picture a railway tunnel with an mm-hmm. opening top. And the Marines, every time they'd fire, they'd get crossfire. And they couldn't get into the cutting because it was, you know, very small. It's very dangerous. So what they did was they took 50-gallon drums of fuel, because Japanese had some fuel there, and they would pour them off the top of the cliff down the cutting and just ignite it and trying to burn the Japanese out. And they did, and the smoke would get in there. And every time a Japanese run out, they'd shoot the Japanese. So they were just using a lot of their own ingenuity and makeshift how to do it.
And this is happening on – this is not only happening on Tulagi, but it's happening on Gavutu and Tanambogo too. The Japanese are holding up in these caves, and that's exactly how they're getting these people out of there. Is like you said, was ingenuity and, you know, a lot of guts, a lot of guts. There was a guy, Torgerson, Harry, was it Harry?
Yeah, Harry Torgerson.
Yeah, Harry Torgerson. He had a rather unique story. I find this happens a lot during World War II, especially in the Pacific Theater, for whatever reason. Guys lose their pants. And it happened to Captain Marines Evans general. on the Johnston.
Oh yeah, just Marines in general. Yeah, always pants comes off.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we'll stay away from that. But this is an instance in which, you know, a Marine loses his pants But Torgerson was doing some of these same types of techniques. He was taking, wasn't he just taking TNT, just dynamite, and putting them, like you said, sticking them on on a 2x4 and jamming them in the hole, and kaboom, you know, up they go.
Yeah, that was on Gavutu. He was doing that, and they were throwing him in because he was in the first parachute battalion. He was doing it on Gavutu in the K's. And I think that one where he blew his pants off and he got so mad, he went back. They said, "Oh, sir, are you bleeding?" He goes, "I'm going back." Same thing happened to Angus Goss. Angus Goss had some, he'd done that too. He was throwing it into a cave on Tulagi, and they threw one back out and it blasted beside him. So he grabbed the Tommy gun apparently and just went straight in there and got him. I think he said, "Oh, the hell with this," and straight in there. But yeah, they were just, they just had to go in there and just dig them out. But like you said, this set the stage for the rest of the Pacific War. Mm-hmm. And in conjunction with some other things that happened on Guadalcanal, you know, a couple of weeks later, and or two within August, the month of August, and that really set the stage. And we'll probably discuss that a bit later. But just while I'm thinking about it, Tulagi, to me, and more I study it, the Tulagi, Gavutu, and Tanimbogo, to me, that was the first serious defeat of the Japanese. Mm-hmm. There's all kind of talk of, you'll get in a heated discussion, and there was this country and this place and this place. But in the Pacific War, because the way I look at it, the Japanese had captured it.
Right.
This was the first offensive to recapture territory. It was the first territory captured. Mm-hmm. The Marines held it. The Japanese never took it back. And we wiped out a whole garrison of Japanese in that area. And it was never taken back.
With an exchange rate that was substantially in our favor. Whereas Guadalcanal took months. And so that you're right. This, we talk about Guadalcanal being the turning point of the war, but Tulagi specifically is the first place where the Japanese were defeated.
Yeah, I think most historians, most people just throw them all in one basket. Tulagi was part of the Guadalcanal campaign, but I look at it separate because they never attempted to retake back Tulagi.
Right.
They were, once they secured Guadalcanal, that was their plan.
They did Guadalcanal. Right.
Well, Tulagi has one of the best fleet anchorages in the whole Pacific. Mm-hmm.
It's important to note too, just like you said, man, that was beautiful, really, because a lot of people don't think about that, you know. And I myself, even when we were doing the intro to this, I lumped Tulagi and Gavutu and Tanimbogo into Guadalcanal, and I mean, it all is part of Watchtower for sure,
part of the campaign.
Right, it is part of the campaign, but it's. These are relatively quick. Yeah, I say quick.
Yeah. For the guys fighting.
Right. Yeah. But truth be told,
three days, you're right.
Right. But when you compare it to Guadalcanal, which is, you know,
months,
6 months, this is a relatively quick boom, boom, in and out kind of a thing. And the casualties rate, Bill, as you said, the casualties, the disparity in the casualties is significant in that. Now, while the paratroopers did suffer some pretty heavy casualties, I mean, the Japanese were killed almost to a man on Gavutu, Tanimbogo, and Tulagi.
They wouldn't surrender, which is another, you know, precedent setting.
Right? Yeah, that's interesting too. Generally, the Special Naval Landing Forces guys generally didn't surrender. I mean, these guys, especially the 3rd Koori Naval Battalion, they're all reservists. There's a great picture of them that shows their NCOs and their officers, and I think their average age is in the 30s. They look pretty hardcore guys. There's a famous picture. So these guys probably fought to the last, but the majority of Japanese on those three little islands were naval air and some laborers. So especially on Tanimbogo, majority of them were, and Tulagi, Tanimbogo and Gavutu, majority of those guys were support personnel. They weren't trained infantry. But once again, you put a man in a cave with a machine gun. But in saying that, there's a few that did attempt to surrender. And there's no written orders, but when the first raiders went in there, they were told, "We're not taking any prisoners." This is even before the Battle of the Tenaru. So we're not taking any prisoners. That was what the raiders, that was their motto and creed. You probably won't find it written down anywhere. It's not nice to talk about, but that's, if you speak to, or a lot of the memoirs and speak to the vets, if they will admit it, they said, yeah, that was, we just went in there and, even if they wanted to surrender, we just take them out. And obviously, some of the Japanese that wanted to surrender too, their own people took them out, or they weren't allowed to. Mm-hmm. There was a number that actually, I think 30 or 40, maybe even more, that actually swam away from the islands and got onto the nearby islands, right, called Florida Islands. Mm-hmm. And then the 2nd Marine Regiment, through the next period of weeks, in conjunction with the locals and especially with the Australian guides, they went and they hunted down everyone that was, and none of them was taken prisoner, apparently. They hunted them down on the islands. They tried to take a few, but yeah. And the, the locals didn't take any prisoners. They found the Japanese. They couldn't sell them. They just kill them. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's something, you know, you hear that. I interviewed a lot of veterans, you know, Bill and Dave, we've talked about this before, and I don't ever remember a Pacific veteran, be it Army or Marine, ever saying they took a prisoner or even tried. And I mean, this, the same could be said for the Japanese too. So, I mean, it wasn't a one-sided thing, but that being said, if there is somebody trying to surrender and, you know, their buddies see him get shot down, well, the idea of surrender goes right out the door, man. It's not happening. Yeah, they ain't happening now.
Yeah, on the side of the Japanese, they thought it. They think they thought this was going to be a raid. I don't think they believed that we were there to stay. And Yamamoto reacted pretty quickly, right, to accelerate the extraction portion of the raid, or what he assumed would be, by ordering an air raid. Is that right?
He did. So I mean, the. That's exactly right. They thought it was a raid initially, according to what I've found. Is that the Japanese did think it was a raid, but once it was realized that, no, this is, you know, a little more intense than a raid, Yamamoto issued orders pretty quickly to kick them out. And by kick them out, I'm talking about the Marines and, you know, all the fleet around there. And of course, we'll see this later at Savo Island.
Right.
But the decisive counterattack is what Yamamoto issued. And or issued the orders for, and that decisive counterattack actually did come by air. Yeah, 100% right, 100% right. Mm-hmm. And that happened, what, Dave, within a couple of hours of the landings on Guadalcanal.
Yeah, so Rabaul was the main base, and right. I forgot the Japanese commander there at Rabaul. They took a bit of the initiative once he got the orders, and he automatically ordered his, I think it was the 25th Air Flotilla. They were geared up to hit Port Moresby. All these Betty bombers, and they had just aerial bombs, and he just took the initiative and said, switch them over to torpedoes and launch a major raid. And something like 80, don't quote me on this, like 70 or 80, is a large number of Japanese bombers, long range zeros and short range zeros. It just took off immediately within hours.
And they were looking for our shipping.
Yeah, they hit the fleet. They hit the fleet. They knew there was a large fleet there, and some of the guys were saying, this isn't a raid. This is just fairly substantial. It's a raid. The guys on the ground in the camps thought it was a raid because they left very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's what they told their superiors. Majority of them, once again, were construction troops. I think they just ran out because they were under naval bombardment, and that's why they've left everything. But there were signs that the Japanese had thought it was a raid because they opened up sites, they opened things up. Well, that was the story. I think it was probably some Japanese opened up real quick and trying to grab money out, just having an opportunity. Who knows? But they got out of there real quick.
yeah. But the answer by the Japanese is rather telling in that it was quick. You know, they sent, like you said, it was an ad hoc force. It was Betty's, it was Val's, it was Zero's, you know, I mean, I'm talking about the dive bombers and, of course, the Zero fighters and the Betty medium bombers. And I forget exactly the number, you know, of aircraft that they sent out there, but it was a fair amount. I mean, it wasn't, you know, like 10, you know, it was several dozen aircraft, 70, something like that. It was a hell of a lot of birds coming down there. And
Fletcher's carriers were still here. He hadn't run away yet, right?
He had not run away yet, no.
Wildcats sitting to go because they knew they were coming.
Yeah. Right. But is that but we had some ground-based aircraft responding as well, didn't we?
Not at
that.
No,
not yet. So because they got warning, they being the carrier task force got warning that our Japanese aircraft were inbound by a coast watcher, if I'm not mistaken, on Buin Island, if I'm not mistaken, said
it was a coast watcher. I think they also had picked up some radio traffic from, once again, naval intelligence. Mm-hmm. A large amount of Japanese radio traffic from a BIOS and potential they're coming. Then the Coast Guards, Coast Watchers verified it when they flew over the rest of the Solomons coming that way.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we didn't have a whole lot of aircraft up as a combat air patrol. There were actually 24 up, but there were only 12 that were in the area, 12 F4F Wildcats that were in the area that could get to these incoming airplanes. Mm-hmm. And they were summarily shot up pretty good. One of the Japanese pilots that was in this group coming through here was the ace, Saburo Sakai. Saburo Sakai had, I believe by this point, had, you know, 56, 58 aerial victories, and he secured a couple of more in this action right here. He shoots down a couple of American future fighter aces, Sutherland being one from the USS Wasp. Yeah, he shoots him down, and he survives, obviously. Both of them do. But one of the more interesting flights that you'll hear about when it comes to World War II is Saburo Sakai's flight over Guadalcanal on August the 7th. After he lights up a couple of F4Fs, he is on a high side and he looks down and he sees a flight of American aircraft and what he initially assumed were more F4Fs, and he dives on them, and of course they're not F4Fs, they're SBD Dauntless Dive Bombers with a tail gun, two twin A&M-2 30 caliber air-cooled machine guns. And Sakai gets hit, his aircraft gets hit. I'm not mistaken, if I think the aircraft actually did catch fire, but regardless of this, he takes a round right, it creases his skull, and he's hurt pretty bad. Sakai loses a serious amount of blood. He's blind,
lost his vision in one eye, right?
Yeah, he did, and he was paralyzed on one side of his body. The airplane's going down, and he essentially comes to as the thing's about to, you know, hit the drink. He pulls out, and I mean, the guy was a machine. He was an absolute machine. He wound up flying back all the way to Rabaul, something like 560 miles. Mm-hmm. And the only way he could remain conscious was by punching himself in his wound. So the shock of pain would actually wake him up as opposed to knocking him out, which it would knock me out personally, I'm just going to say. But apparently it didn't, Saburo Sakai. He actually brought that bird home. He landed this thing.
Amazing.
But the thing was about this, and this goes into, and we'll do this, you know, here and there. We kind of, you know, talk about future events, but the fact is that in this aerial melee that occurs over the invasion fleet, the United States loses a lot of fighters. Like, we lose a lot of fighters. By the end of the day, due to mechanical failure, Japanese aggressive tactics, and just, you know, poor defensive tactics or aggressive offensive tactics on our side by the F4S, we lose almost half of our fighter capability coming off the aircraft carriers in one day. And this is one of the
reasons. That's not including the Cactus Air Force losses later.
No, I mean, this is just August 7th. Yeah, this is right. This is USS Wasp and Enterprise and the carriers that are right there, or, you know, or near there, actually. And this is one of the reasons that, one of the many reasons that Fletcher actually decides to beat feet and get out of there. He didn't have enough aircraft or enough fighter planes to, you know, ward off an incoming attack. He watches the he hears about the torpedo attack from the Bettys that are coming in there and lighting up some of the transports. They hit several of the ships in there, but I don't believe they sank any, except for the George F. Elliott. Yeah. George F. Elliott goes down, right?
And the next day was a major raid, too. And I think that's the one, I don't want to get them confused, where you get the famous photo and shows the Bettys at 3 or 4 feet off of, that's what they were doing, they're flying underneath, because they were told, I think they were told the Americans didn't have any aircraft, couldn't depress their guns that low. Mm-hmm. One of the techniques, I mean, I might be incorrect, but that's what the Navy memoirs I read was. But they found that that wasn't the right case. Mm-hmm. They shot all of them out of the air, I think.
Yeah, there were some significant losses on the Japanese side. And those photographs, I know exactly what you're talking about, Dave. I mean, if there's a guy hanging out the bottom of that bird on that Betty, his toes are dipping in the water.
I mean, they great are flying, low. Great flying skills.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, balls a solid rock to fly an airplane that fast, that low. But jumping back real quick before we get back to Guadalcanal, we talked about the casualty figures on Gavutu, Tanambogo, and Tulagi, and how disproportionate they were. I got the numbers here. The total casualties for Tulagi, Gavutu, and Tanambogo were 122 killed in action for the Marine Corps. The Japanese lose something like 860 killed in action. And I mean, Dave, you may be able to give me an exact number on that, but I mean, it's roughly in that neighborhood, is it not?
Yes, that's correct. I think there were over 300 and all depends who you, what source you read, but about 350 on Tulagi, and I think they captured three. But there's a photo of some Japanese, they say Japanese prisoners, you will see once again on Guadalcanal, but they're generally Korean laborers. And there's mm-hmm. a picture of a few on Tulagi, Gavutu and Tanambogo, and they're either Japanese naval air, majority of them are laborers, Korean laborers.
Well, so to put that in perspective, though, that's almost as many Japanese lost KIA as the U.S. Navy would lose at Savo Island when we get to that, right? And then that was the worst American defeat, Navy defeat in history.
Yeah, over 1,000.
But for the Japanese, this is the kind of a precursor of things to come, because this loss here would look small compared to future losses. And again, for perspective, we lost about that number of sailors in the sinking USS Indianapolis in 1945. So, but this is just three small islands during the Guadalcanal campaign where the Japanese army or naval forces, infantry, lost these, 800 and something.
Yeah, it basically killed them to the man.
And it gets worse. It gets worse. Almost all the ground combat instances on Guadalcanal, of which we're going to talk about one just here in a second. The casualties on the Japanese side were absolutely horrendous. I mean, absolutely. And part of it is due to their tactics. Part of it is also due to their lack of will to surrender, desire to surrender, whatever you want to say. They were absolutely horrendous. And that being said, for the first 3 weeks, from August 7th through, well, let's just say August 7th through the 20th of August on Guadalcanal, there is some sporadic firefights here and there, right, Dave? I mean, there's patrolling actions. We're running into Japanese, but there's nothing big. There's no real big hardcore actions.
There is one. Now, you got to remember the Getchi Patrol on the, on the 12th of Okay, we lost, or the U.S. lost 25 Marines. There's a number of Japanese, but then the punitive, I guess, expedition that was on the 19th of August, that was involved a whole battalion size attack against the Japanese on the Tanikau riverfront, which ended up killing roughly about 70 or 80 Japanese. That was the guard company. That was the guard company that I mentioned earlier. They had established themselves at the mouth of the Tanikau, and that's what Colonel Getchi and the famous Getchi Patrol ran straight into. And that was a bit of an area that the Vandegrift wanted to wipe out. And on the 19th, they did a small operation where they did actual amphibious assault, and they sent an envelopment. And they replicated like three other times on the Tanikau, but that was the only real big action they had before the 20th.
And the 20th, there's a patrol that helps lead to actions that follow here. And it's led by a gentleman named Brush. Can you tell us a little bit about what's known as the Brush Patrol and what happens there? What does it lead to? That kind of stuff.
Yeah, so the Japanese had landed. Once again, I don't know how much in depth I'm going to get to, but the Japanese response, the first Japanese Army response was the 28th Regiment, the Chiki Detachment, under Colonel Chiki, who was the Japanese colonel. And this was the unit that was slated to invade Midway, but once again, due to the Midway battle, they were turned back. So they went to Guam for a while, and they were on their way back to Japan. And then they were diverted to truck, put on ships. And Chiki said, look, he was given the orders to take his best guys in the first echelon. So he had a number of companies. He picked his best guys, and he basically slimmed down his companies. They put them on fast transports. And he had two echelons. The first echelon was his guys they didn't have their heavy weapons. I think they only had some heavy machine guns, light machine guns, and a couple of 70-millimeter cannons or infantry support guns. And the rest of these artillery is going to come in a second echelon on transports. They put on six, I think, fast transports, destroyers, and they shot them down. They landed on the east coast. The eastern side of the Marine perimeter at Tavu Point, which is probably 8 miles away to the east. Then they started, once they landed, they had some intelligence on the Marine positions. They knew obviously the Marines there, and they severely underestimated the number of Marines there. And Ichiki was given the kind of loose orders from the 17th Japanese Army to make a reconnaissance, and if he wanted to take his own initiative to attack, but wait for his second echelon, which was supposed to arrive 3 days later.
So he's patrolling through the jungle, not the beach, right?
Yeah, well, not yet. So they've landed. Mm-hmm. And so they've landed that fresh Japanese unit. So the Marines at that stage was doing active patrolling. So they knew the Japanese, they didn't really know what was going on, but that was one of the things that all the Marines do. They set out outposts, do active patrolling to find out to gather intelligence. So I think a couple of days before they had a platoon, it went out and forgot his name. He was a second lieutenant. They were in 1st Battalion of the 1st Marines. He was an Alpha Company, I think. Yeah, Alpha Company. And he'd went out with his platoon and did a reconnaissance and had found a little village with orange grove and things like that, and he moved back. So the local Solomon Islanders had the scouts out. So he had Martin Clemens, who was the coast watcher, and he had local Solomon scouts working for him, like the name Jacob Vuza and a few of the other famous Solomon Island scouts. So they were getting reports back to some Japanese had landed. They knew there was some Japanese. They seen the transports, those fast destroyers, and they think, well, it might have been a landing there. So we'll send a large patrol to replicate what this lieutenant did, but we'll just give a reinforced platoon of about 60 Marines. And the captain, the company commander, took overall control, and his name was Brush. So they went down the coastal track, which was a pre-war track, and they started moving to Tavu Point to the east side. The Japanese, that stage, they wanted to know the Marine position. So what Ichiki did, he took his, engineer officer and a number of officers, formed a reconnaissance party, roughly 30-something Japanese, to go and make a reconnaissance on the Marine positions and report back. So the Japanese had moved out. They weren't expecting the Marines to be that far away from the perimeter. So from the accounts, one of the best books, and I've got it here, I don't know if you've read it, it's a William Barsh's book, Victory mm-hmm. Fever of Guadalcanal. Mm-hmm. Great book. It goes in a lot of detail on this, and they cover it from the Japanese perspective. A lot of Japanese records you've went into. But the Japanese really didn't expect, I think the way you read it, they're just walking down the government trail. They didn't have their flank security and the right security out. And the Marines are walking. So it's almost like a media engagement. Marines are coming down one way, Japanese come down the other way. So the Marines stopped. They had their flanks out. They had their scouts out. But one of the lieutenants remembered this little village with the orange grove. Let's move into this village with the orange, nice oranges. That's where we can have a bit of a rest. So they're moving there, and they started hearing gunfire. So what the lead Solomon Island scout and the lead Marine scouts ran into the Japanese, and then a firefight ensued. The Japanese got pinned down. So the Brush Patrol ended up almost wiping the whole Japanese patrol out. I think maybe two or three Japanese managed to make their way back wounded. In this patrol, which is the Marines gathered vital intelligence, because they looked at the dead. They knew there was a large amount of officers in this small patrol of 30. And this is a bit strange. Mm-hmm. They knew they had fresh uniforms on, so they freshly landed. And more importantly, they had the Japanese Army insignia on. At that stage, Marines hadn't met the Japanese Army. They knew there was only Japanese Special Naval Landing or Japanese Naval troops there. And they knew that these guys were freshly landed. And they also was also carrying a lot of documents. Some of the documents say, you read in some accounts that they knew every position of the Marines was marked down on these maps, but that's really not the case. They had general maps of the Marine perimeter, but the maps wasn't completely filled in. That was the role of these guys. They were going to go there, then fill in the rest of the map.
Where could they have gotten that intel from? Sorry? That from airborne surveillance? Where did they get that intel from?
I would say airborne surveillance.
Okay.
I would say aero reconnaissance. They'd flew over. But they had a loose, and they might have had some guys on the ground. I never read any accounts of any Solomon Islanders. But they had some guys on the ground, too. Remember, some of these guys, they had over 2,000 Japanese had fled to the jungles. Right. Some actually went to the east. In fact, in this patrol, they had, I think, two or three of the Japanese naval construction guys who were there pre-war leading them there as guides. So they may have been giving them some reconnaissance. Because during this time, the Marines were getting some sporadic sniper fire, they call it. So there might have been a few Japanese there gaining some intel, and they just briefed up Ichiki when they landed. So when once Ichiki, the survivors made it back, and two or three, and said, look, we've been ambushed. They formed a – he formed all his guys in the columns, and they just went straight down there very quick to try to get the Americans. There's still three Americans missing. I helped one of my friends, Jeff Riker, from Missing Marines. Mm-hmm. We're always trying to look for the missing Marines there. And there was three Marines that was buried in unmarked graves, and they've left their boondockers or boots sticking up. So they obviously go back there in the next few days and pick them up. But when the Japanese, it was just at night, and they gathered all the bodies, and they noticed there was three bodies wrapped in ponchos. It was a bit bigger than everyone else. And then once they got the torch or the flashlights out, look, they're Americans. So they cremated the majority of the Japanese dead. So I don't know what they did with those three Americans. I don't know if they reburied them or they were cremated too. So who knows? Mm-hmm. But once again, at that stage, Ichiki, he was a bit shot, but that set the ball rolling. And the brush patrol, then brush, they got back and gave that intel and said, look, there's a Japanese fresh unit had landed. Here's some of the maps. And the Marines had already been preparing the positions anyway, but I'll stop there now.
And that's an important point. That's an important point that you said, that the Marines had already been preparing positions, because, you know, there's a common misconception that, you know, you mentioned Jacob Fusa, that Fusa, you know, there's the whole story of Fusa, you know, crawling on his hands and knees back to the, to Marine lines and saying, hey, you know, this big assault's coming. They're right behind me. And all of a sudden the Marines rush up to the Tinaroo River and set up their positions. And then everything comes after that. That is completely untrue, completely untrue. And that the Marines had been setting up positions in and around Tinaroo River, Alligator Creek, Elu River, whatever the hell you want to call it. All three, you know, history knows that it is all three, regardless. Yeah. That Marines had been setting up positions in that area for a couple of days. I mean, this was not something
more than that.
It wasn't anything that was rushed. You know, it wasn't like, oh, God, we got to get out there and let everybody go dig a hole. It didn't work like that. That was not it at all.
They were doing what they were supposed to be doing in preparation of the battlefield.
Yeah, exactly.
Vandegrift. When they landed there, Vandegrift, obviously, he didn't have enough Marines to have a 360-degree perimeter. The most important thing was it was a counterattack and straight into defensive posture. So he had to protect that airfield. So he had basically five battalions. If you're not counting special weapons battalion and the pioneer and the engineers, but you had five infantry battalions. So you put the 5th Marines, he formed a horseshoe shaped perimeter because they were expecting when the Japanese were going to attack, especially the Marine mindset, they're going to do amphibious assault. And the best beaches to land on is going to be Lunga Point. They're going to hit straight Lunga Point, straight into the airfield. So he set his main defenses on the beach, but he also knew that the coastal tract was on his flanks, on his west and east flanks. So it was the horseshoe covered that, and his right flank, which would be his east flank, was centered on Alligator Creek or Elu River.
Right.
And the southern flank was covered by outposts on places like Edson's Ridge and with the pioneers and engineers, and he had active patrolling. That's when he had a lot of active patrolling to try to cover that response. So a week before the 21st, Marines had about the 1st Marines, that was the 1st Marines sector, the Elu River, Alligator Creek. So one of the battalions, that was their sector. So they had about 200 yards down the river set up. They were covering the only place, the coastal track now was this pre-war track. There wasn't any bridges across the Elu River. The Elu River is mainly a coastal tidal lagoon.
It was pretty shallow though, wasn't it?
Yeah, at the beginning, in the actual lagoon itself is deep, and then it peters out as it goes north, but it's mainly, and that's why you have the sandbar. Now the sandbar served, especially on low tide, sandbar served as a crossing point for the coastal track. So if you're going to get any vehicle traffic across that, you got to go by the sandbar. Mm-hmm. That was the same with the Matanikau River at the time. There was no bridges there. So they put there's defenses on that sandbar to center around that sandbar because that was the main avenue of approach. But they had about 100, 200 yards before that. But once more intelligence started coming in that this potential Japanese attack, they extended, this was probably a week before, they extended that line down for another almost 1,000 yards. So they had an East Bank 1,000 yards. And they started digging in coconut log bunkers. The Marines had some good positions dug in, had coconut logs on top, enclosed bunkers. They started putting their heavy guns there. They started pre-registering their artillery in the, on the sandbar, and then opposite. They
established their fields of fire and all of that then.
Yeah, and they had it set up. So but they had a fixed defense. They didn't have any barbed wire because, once again, when the ships pulled out prematurely, yes, funny you say that. There was 18. Yeah. Right. Australian humor. Anyway, 18 spools of barbed wire was offloaded, only 18 spools. But pre-war, that was all coconut plantations. Right. So what they did was they started stripping all the barbed wire off the coconut plant because they had a lot of cows there to keep down the vegetation. And they had to keep the cows in with the barbed wire. So they're stripping all the barbed wire off. And you read the accounts of the Marines, they were really, once again, working parties, and it was pretty bad working parties. You stripped this barbed wire and put the barbed wire up. But they were only managed to put one little strand of barbed wire on the east end of that sandbar. They put a few more toward the west side, the western end, almost like Tanglefoot. But they only have one strand about knee high on the end of the Japanese when you come on. But to answer your original question, the Marines knew that the Japanese were coming, and that had their defensive set up ready to go. Yeah. And they had outposts too. The Reed had combat outposts. You've got the Ilu River, and you had the Tenaru River, which was about a mile away, if that. And they were, as you know, we mentioned before, the map names. That's why it was called the Tenaru, which was actually Ilu. But they actually had combat outposts there. The Marines did during the day, and at night they pulled their listening posts, but they had enough warning, the Marine warning post out. I mean, they were just doing their normal doctrine.
Right.
They knew what they were doing. Right.
So, you know, you mentioned Kiyono or Ichiki Kiyono, depending on how you want to address him.
Or Ichiki, some people call it. Yeah.
He was a rather unique character. And let's talk about him because, in my opinion, professionally, his personality kind of led to his own demise, frankly. He was known as an expert in infantry tactics, which is kind of bizarre if you know anything about how the Tenaru River battle unfolds. It's not really how you would think an infantry expert would do this sort of thing. But, you know, I mean, the guy had a pretty checkered past. You know, he commanded some rifle units in China. He had some significant combat experience. You know, it's rumored, and I never did find clarification. I could not confirm this, but it is said on several books, including, you know, Richard Frank's book on Guadalcanal, that his actions, Ichiki's actions, are what led to the Marco Polo Bridge incident in 1937, which a lot of people, myself included, point to being the actual start of World War II, not the invasion of Poland in 1939. Mm-hmm. Regardless of this, Ichiki is very headstrong. He's very, very arrogant, shall we say. He's arrogant in the fact that he believes that he and his people can do whatever.
There's no way they're going to lose.
No way in hell. Yeah. They're going to, you know, go through the Marine lines like that. You know, no matter who's there, no matter what's there, he's very confident. He's very confident in his abilities to utterly destroy the Marines. He, unlike a lot of Japanese commanders too, he believed in the sword. And I mean, this is something that, again, that goes on all the way through the war, you know, that he believed in the sword as opposed to maybe, you know, some more modern infantry tactics, even though he was a so-called infantry expert. And he believed that his people could, you know, overtake any defensive position that he would encounter. So Dave, as they're moving down towards their meeting with fate, the Japanese now I'm talking about, they're moving at Marine lines that are fixed. They're prepared. There's reserve units behind them. I mean, the Marines on that line, on that defensive line, they were ready for just about anything that's going to come. And the Japanese were not prepared for this at all. Ichiki, as he's moving his people down towards the Tenaru River, he's not really taking much caution, is he?
I think what he wanted to do was he was relying on speed and shock. Mm-hmm. Night attack, speed and shock that worked all the time against the other forces. This is what they do. We hit them. We'll overcome them with our spirit, so to speak. There's a heavily relied upon. We'll hit them in a fixed small point. We'll infiltrate. We'll hit them hard at night, and because they're not night fighters, and they'll run.
Was this his first operation against Americans?
Yes. Ichiki had the combat experience from China. Mm-hmm. So I think he was relying on the shock techniques. They didn't know what the Marines had at that stage. They only knew there were 2,000. He thought, well, there's 2,000 Marines here. We know the perimeter. There can't be that many of them at that fixed point. So if I hit them, I think he had 900 guys. If I hit them right. with, you know, 900 in stacks, 300, 300, 300, we'll just punch through because it can't be no more than if they're scattered over a 5 or 6 mile perimeter, and there's only 2,000 of them. There can't be that many holding the area, and we'll punch straight through them. Mm-hmm. And at that stage, there were 11,000 Marines there. And in fact, the mouth of the Alligator Creek was the most heavily fortified position the Marines had. So what Ichiki did, he sent his first unit, first platoon up, his reconnaissance platoon mm-hmm. with a lieutenant. And once again, if you go into Bill Barsh's book, he goes into detail what each how the survivors who are actually in that first group we're talking about. And he names the lieutenants and all that. And they moved up and they could, one of the Marine BAR men in the outpost line engaged them with a BAR and a flare went up. Marine shot a flare in the air. So that kind of initiated and the outpost pulled across and went back across the river. So Japanese knew that, okay, we're getting to the creek. I don't think they knew because they'd crossed one river,
right,
which is the Tenaru, and that's where they got hit, the first point with the outpost. The Japanese were a bit confused. At night, they didn't really know exactly how close they were to the airfield. And the Japanese reports was when they hit the Marine main line, they didn't think the Marine line was that far out from the airfield. But if you look in reality, even the airfield, it ain't that far. Right. It isn't that far. Mm-hmm. So Japanese, I don't think, really knew where they were at and what was going on, especially at night. Very confusing, especially the combat at night. So the first group was only platoon size. You read some accounts, they sent 200 across and 100. That's not what it was. The first group was 40. One platoon size went across, and they got hit quite hard. So I think they were committed. They pulled back. Another group went. They pulled back. By that time, Ichiki had arrived on the battlefield and got to, okay, this is what's going on. So at that stage, you can understand, you get your first elements, a contact, very confusing. They draw back. What do we got? Okay, they got heavy defenses there. So a good commander, and this is when it goes back to what Seth was saying with the arrogance, a good commander at that stage would reassess the situation. Okay, we've hit a hard point here. It's a greater resistance than we expect. Let's pull my supporting arms out. Either we'll flank these guys, which is mm-hmm. Japanese techniques of flanking. But I think that was a big why. Why didn't they go down the beach and flank the Marine positions? I think Ichiki knew that he was in a hurry. He was in a hurry. He wanted to take the airfield. He wanted to punch through. He thought we could punch through him. We're in a hurry. Does he want to get to glory, get a credit? Who knows? But this goes back to the arrogance. And that's he made a poor decision at that stage. Once he assessed the situation, I think the next major assault wasn't supported. And then once that assault, and that was a larger assault, larger number, he pushed across. They didn't make it. Then he brought his supporting arms up. And he said, well, okay, let's just try to knock some of these Marine machine guns out. And then
he doubled down on his poor decision and then said, okay, let's do this. Let's try to do this the right way.
The right way.
A whole bunch of losses.
Yeah. So I think it goes back to the whole thing. He was in a hurry. He underestimated his enemy and terrain, and he was relying on the bamboo spear tactics.
Yeah. And that's 100%. He underestimated his enemy is what it was, I think, personally. You know, I've read accounts that said that, you know, he fully expected, or at least his men said that he fully expected that when they hit the Marines, no matter how many there were, that the Marines were going to break and run, and that was it. Goodbye, ball game. And that is not what happened. And not only did they run into fixed positions, but Dave, they're running into the Japanese are running into some heavy, heavy, heavy weapons there. There's 50 caliber machine guns. There's 1917 water cooled machine guns. There's 37 millimeter anti-tank guns loaded with canister shot. I mean, these are some these weapons are specifically, they're absolutely perfect for stopping mass human wave assaults. And that's essentially what's coming across that river right there at that sandbar. And they're running right into the teeth of these marine defenses. And these guys are just getting chopped to pieces.
And this is what, after midnight when they're doing all this?
Yeah.
The assaults?
Yeah.
Yeah, early in the morning.
Early, yeah.
On the 21st. And if you go on my YouTube page, I've got the Bala Alligator Creek. Mm-hmm. If you go on there, you can see how small the battlefield is. And also you can see how the marine machine gun positions and inflate fire. And then the 37 millimeters, how close it was and how small that sandbar is and how much intensive fire is coming down in that area. And you also had the 81 millimeters mortars, which the Lieutenant Colonel Pollock, who's the battalion commander of the Marines at that area, said the 81s millimeter mortars was probably did the most damage of all. And I found that very surprising, but he's the lieutenant colonel at the time, the commander on the scene, always thinking that 37 millimeters. But he had two 37 millimeter guns firing those giant canister, 120, I think, 8 rounds of buckshot, basically 30 caliber, one big blast, one big shotgun blast. And at times, it was this guy's, this first special weapons battalion, the Marines had a first special weapons battalion, it was their guns. They had one of the guns. They had a 37 millimeters. Their main purpose was for beach defense to take out boats. That's what Vandegrift had set these 50 cals and 37 millimeters to anti-boat defense. Then you had the 37 or the 30 caliber machine guns between them. So they ended up one stage had one 37 pointing down the sandbar for that. And the other one was pointing toward the sea. So they tried to pull it to the right hand side, but they ended up taking the sandbags out and just pulling it out and just swirling it around. But during the battle, one of the guns was taken out quite early by a Japanese knee mortar, Japanese knee launcher or grenade knee launcher. And you notice it goes back and forth. And infantry guys are jumping on these 37 millimeters and running them and they fire a few rounds. And then they, you know, every once in a while, they'll get killed or wounded, the Marines and another one, the crew would jump in there. Yeah, it's a big Edward.
This is guy straight out of his name is straight out of a Hollywood movie. Johnny Rivers comes to mind. What was this guy all about? Was that
he was a machine gunner? They're in there. Rivers is he's one of the first guys that theoretically opens fire against the Japanese as they're coming across that tidal lagoon right there. One of the things that you know the stories is that he's firing tracer ammunition, and of course, as a, you know, there's a famous saying that tracers point both ways. And Rivers is killed pretty early in the action, isn't he, Dave?
Yeah, different accounts. A lot of the I guess standard account is he's hitting the head, killed instantly.
Right.
Yeah, he's probably hitting the head. But I'm speaking to one of the veterans who walked by his body the next day, and he said it took a burst in the chest too. So it was probably a burst machine gun. Once you said once they started firing, they started drawing all kind of fire from the Japanese.
Mm-hmm. Right. He gets killed. And then I forget the exact process. I think Diamond takes over the weapon and then he gets hit. Weapon.
Schmidt takes over.
Diamond takes over.
Diamond's he's the team leader. He's the corporal. So he starts to be the loader. So Schmidt starts firing. Yeah.
And they've Diamond
for a long time.
Yeah. He fires for ages, it seems like. And he takes a grenade fragment to the face that, it doesn't actually permanently blind him. He actually does regain some of his vision later on in life through many, many, many surgeries. But at this stage in the battle, he can't see. And this one of the, you know, it's a story that's rather legendary, but it has a lot of truth to it in that, you know, even though he was blinded, he was still firing up on the Japanese as they were coming across the sandbar by sound. Diamond was also theoretically guiding his actions as he's firing the weapon. Yeah, because Diamond didn't he take it in the shoulder or the arm or something like that?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. So he couldn't operate. Diamond couldn't operate the weapon, but Schmidt could, even though he couldn't see. And they stayed in there for a good bit until they were relieved by other machine gunners from H Company 2nd Battalion. It was machine gunners from H Company 2nd Battalion first, and then, if I'm not mistaken, some G Company riflemen came in there and got those guys out of there as well later on through the night.
Mm-hmm. They had the, if you go there, especially look at my video, they had the first higher area on the Marine bank. So their gun had a very dominating position. So once they started firing, they couldn't traverse far all the way to the left, because they took out their, what they generally do is you have a traverse an elevation on a machine gun and it's locked in, go left and right, and you put sticks up. So if you take it off and you can free gun it, they call it go left and right, it's your left limit, your right limit, it hits the sticks and stops. So that way you can't swing it over and shoot someone, your own troops to left and right. But what these guys did, they could traverse it all the way and cover all the sandbar. So they end up, because they were in a sandbag bunker, they end up kicking the front sandbags out and to the left and right, so they could traverse it all the way over. So at that stage, they needed to fire over the top of the other Marines' heads and things. So they were firing a lot, and they were getting so much attention from the Japanese. And the Japanese, you probably did some reading, there was an Amtrak, a Marine amphibious tracker.
Yes, in the river.
Yeah, so what they used to do is look that when this was the first time they're using Amtraks, and Amtraks were mainly wasn't used at that stage for landing crafts. They were used in places like water trucks, they called them, to bring in supplies, and they were that's what they were using for. And then I forgot the captain's name. He was an Amtrak. They come up with an engineer. They come up with a system to form a bridge. And there's a couple of good photos on Guadalcanal. It showed the two Amtraks in the river. Then they had a corduroy bridge over them, so they could ford the rivers very quickly. So initially, when they first landed in the 7th and 8th and 9th of August, one of the Amtraks went into the Alligator Creek, was forming a bit of the bridge. That was what was like a pontoon. So for some reason, it got bogged or stuck. I'm using Australian languages again. It got stuck there on the east bank, or in the east bank of the river. So that became very important during the battle, because the Japanese seen it, and they ended up swimming out and putting a machine gun in it. And that machine gun caused so much trouble. And it was directly across from the River Smith and Diamond's bunker. And that was the machine gun. They think it's probably taken out, I don't know as much Rivers, I think he was taken out a bit early. But it was giving them a lot of grief. And then if you ever read to Sid Phillips, and you, when you spoke to Sid Phillips, did he mention about that Amtrak?
He does. They all do. Anybody who is up there towards the front of that action up near the sandbar, they all talk about that Amtrak, that there was fire coming out of that Amtrak, that they would put, the Marines would shoot back at that fire, seemingly knock it out, and it would erupt again. You know, it was kind of an ongoing thing through the night. And that's something, too, to note about Teneru, Ilu, Alligator, whatever we want to call it, August 21st, is that we'll just cover it right there, is that this wasn't a one and done thing. You know, I mean, the Japanese kept throwing people across the sandbar, and they actually did try to move down a little bit down the river.
Some of the engineers guys went down the river
and they got hammered. I mean, they were not getting through this line. I mean, they did. I can't remember if it was the first wave or the second wave. Actually, you know, you talked about it. They knocked out one of those 37 millimeter guns. They got in there, and you know, the fighting got down to hand to hand in some locations. So they actually did get close, but they were never going to break that line all the way through. But regardless of this, the fighting, it wasn't just, you know, one or two waves like you see in the HBO miniseries of Pacific, you know, where it's, you know, just a bunch of guys coming across and there's a lot of shooting and then it's over with. This went on all night long, all morning long, I guess is a more appropriate term, right? After midnight all the way until daybreak, and this is, you know, 900 and some odd guys of Ichiki's unit there that are in that general vicinity, and you know, they're not moving no matter, you know, they've stopped coming across the river in human waves because it's not working. To put it bluntly, it ain't working. And they're by morning they're holed up in a coconut grove. Am I right there, Dave?
Yeah, directly across the Marines. And there's some theories, and I tend to think about this theory of why they were doing it, because they lost all their command and control, because most of the officers are dead. And in fact, the survivors, it was there, said Ichiki probably died in that third assault, the last assault. So that's why they were a bit confused and they didn't have any orders. And once again, you know, that they didn't decentralize their command, a very centralized command. If no one's telling them what to do, they're just going to stay there.
Yeah. Kind of like rats in a trap. They're just,
and no one's telling them what to do. And that was the whole theory of, and I don't know if you're about to discuss it, but the Japanese version, the official Japanese version was, you know, Colonel Chiki did the right, horrible thing. And he killed himself and he burned his colors. But I tend to believe in what the survivors are actually saying. The Japanese that did survive said, no, Chiki died during the fighting. You know, he was an infantry commander. Mm-hmm. He says, well, I'll just die in the last assault and I'll lead my men in the last assault. And he probably did die. And that's why they were so confused and muddled in the morning daylight came.
Well, that goes exactly with the type of personality that we described Chiki as, you know, is that the first two assaults are slaughtered. You know, I mean, almost to a man, they're slaughtered. And it's probably obvious on him that's like, well, if anybody's going to get this done, it's going to be me. And, you know, I mean, that I agree with you. I firmly believe that at that point, you know, I don't think he tears the colors and, you know, all this other jazz. That's the sexy romantic Hollywood way of getting it done. I don't think that's how it happened either. I think Ichiki said, well, I'm going to get this done. And he's the one that forced tried to force the issue. And I have no doubt that he was cut down by canister fire or machine gun fire or both. And, you know, he's one of those guys that's laying there as that footage is taken the following morning. The Marines are kind of, you know, sauntering along through the field of dead. I'm sure Ichiki's one of those guys.
Yeah. And so the upshot of all this is over on those three islands, Tulagi and such, nearly all of the almost 900 Japanese on those islands die. And then this Ichiki raid here with his almost 800 Japanese, nearly all of them die.
Right.
And these are the first major engagements between the United States Marine Corps and the Japanese. We had to be feeling pretty good at this point.
Well, I know, you know, the guys that were there the following morning, guys like Sid Phillips and Edmund DeRoche and Frank Pomeroy guys, all these are all H Company guys that were, you know, still sitting there the following morning. These are some of the guys that went and walked around through the field of dead that you see, you know, that's where that footage was shot. And they were, yeah. But I mean, this is way late in the afternoon when that footage was taken, because as I said, this battle didn't end when the sun came up, you know?
Right.
And the Marines to kind of finish the action, it's a pretty nasty little action. They're calling Pollock is calling, he's ordering artillery to be fired in this coconut grove. And they're chewing the Japanese up in there. And, you know, there's a theory that the artillery actually broke up another, another assault that was coming along. But who knows? You know, as you said, Dave, these guys were probably holed up in there because they had nowhere else to go and they didn't know what to do. And the artillery is just dropping in there and chewing them up. But that's not even the end of it. They sent some tanks over there. And that comes straight from Vandergriff, does it not? That order to send the tanks?
But it does. It had a maneuver. The only reserve he had was the 1st Battalion of the 1st Marines on the Crestwell. That was their maneuver battalion. So what he said, Cates, which is almost, he was the regimental commander of the 1st Marines, one of the most famous.
Clifton Cates, yep.
Yeah, Clifton Cates. He's one of my favorite Marines, especially from World War One. But Cates said, someone said, those guys are over there. He goes, those people, I forgot exactly what he said, but paraphrase him. He says, they're holed up there, get them out.
Yeah, I think exactly what he said is I'm not going to let these people sit up here all day.
Head up all day. Good, get them out. And so he took the 1st Battalion of the 1st Marines, and they moved down about 1,500 meters down the creek, and they did an envelopment to trap those Japanese in there. And at one stage, they're fixed bayonets, and they were moving through there, and there was a bit of they had to actually some nasty fights in there. To try to get these Japanese out. And you mentioned the tanks. They brought the tanks, and the only place out, like I said before, they could cross was at the sandbar. And then, that's what Vandergriff said, the back of the tanks looked like, you know, meat grinders. Because that's the only way they could go across. And what I was reading, some accounts, the Japanese were up in trees and the tanks would hit the tree and knock the Japanese out. They'd take fire and they just hit the tree and the whole tree would fall and all the Japanese would fall out and the Marines would shoot them. There was one story I was reading, one account where this young private, because they're coconut plantation trees, they're planting rows.
Right.
So he's moving through there and there was a Japanese behind a tree and he kept ducking in and ducking out. And the gunnery sergeant. He goes, I can't see him, Gunny. I can't see him, Gunny. He goes, he's behind a tree. He said, shoot through the effing tree. So he shot through the tree and got in the Japanese. And there's all kinds of stories like that. I think the famous story about the Marine marksman when he's got up there with his campaign hat and put his shooting jacket on. And that story was, he was supposed to be like his top-ended pre-war marksman.
Right.
And he brought up his shooting jacket, which is a Marine, you know, marksman's shooting jacket to do in competitions. He had his old, like, Smokey Bear hat, campaign hat on.
Yeah.
And he took his good seating position and got his sling on his arm, like he's back on the rifle range. And there was some Japanese out in the surf trying to get back. And all the Marines were watching him go, oh, this is our famous shooter. We see what he does. And I think his first couple of shots, he missed. and they're going, oh, what's going on? But then they said, then he got his groove, so to speak. And then, unfortunately for the Japanese, they'd hit him in the head and it'd go down. So there was a lot of, I don't think it's like you see in the Pacific. I think they wanted to replicate that just to show the atmosphere that at that stage it was kind of over. But but there was a lot of nasty fighting in that area with the tanks and the 1st Battalion, 1st Marines moving through there.
The tanks that they were under a guy named Lieutenant Case, I believe, is who was leading that little group of tanks going in there, and the man in the forward there, in the forward positions there. But that was the end of it, pretty much, really. Once those tanks got in there, and 1-1 came up, and they pushed in, they just kind of closed that loop. They kind of closed the noose, if you will, in and around that coconut grove. Mm-hmm. At that point, and this is. Mid to late morning, you know, I want to say it's before lunch, it's before noon, but not much later than that. And this is essentially the end of the Tenaru battle. And it's almost complete destruction of Ichiki's people. He sends, you know, roughly 900 people in there, and they count, you know, there's all kinds of different estimates. They say 2,100 Japanese were killed. Well, that's not even remotely close, but it was about 700 guys that they killed in that area, wasn't it?
Yeah, almost around eight, because Bill Barsh and Richard Frank, a few of the historians, they've got the records, especially from the Japanese. They'd landed with 900 and something, left 100 his rear guard back in Taibu Point. And then he had landed with 900, left 100 back in Taibu Point, and then 30 made it back, 30 survivors, because the Taibu Point, when the second echelon landed, there was about 130 the Ichiki detachment still left. So yeah, roughly a little about 750-ish approximately. Another thing too, we forgot to mention, on the 20th, the day before, the Cactus Air Force had landed. They first landed on the island, and then this mock-up campaign, the Wildcats got to be involved. So the Wildcats were coming down and strafing them with the 50 cals in that little pocket too.
But we talked about the Japanese casualties here on the 21st, you know, 700 and plus killed in action. The Marine losses were significantly less. I mean, any you know, Marine that's killed is a tragic loss, but there were 44, I believe, is the actual number of killed in action, and about 70 wounded in the action. So I mean, it's a significant, and again, it's much like Tulagi and Gavutu and Tanambogo, the differences in casualty figures are astounding, absolutely astounding. But there's one more thing I want to talk about before we wrap it up, and this is, we touched on it earlier, the Japanese refusal to surrender. And I know you mentioned this, you got a letter from Vandegrift to Holcomb, and it's, if I'm not mistaken, it's like days, like maybe a day.
One day later.
Yeah. After this action, the Marines, probably Navy corpsmen are going out among the wounded and the dead at Hell's Point out there at the sandbar and in and around the area, trying to see if there's anybody Japanese now that they can save. And there's multiple cases of the Japanese who are wounded there, you know, trying to shoot or shooting some of the people that are coming there to save them, or to at the very least, you know, render some sort of assistance to them. And at that point, the order goes down to the Marines out there, you know, just start pumping rounds at anything that you see out there. And then Vandegrift writes this letter. What does he say to Holcomb in regards to the Japanese way of fighting and their will to die, seemingly die?
Yeah, I don't have a copy of it. It's on my computer, but you've read it in a few accounts. People pull this section out. He basically says, I've never seen such fighting as this. These people never surrender. And he goes to mention the Coleman instances. And that letter too is very he thinks the Ichiki is a raid too. He said Japanese have done a raid, and he mentions in there one sentence to Holcomb. He says, "I think they've read about this commando thing, and they wanted to try it. Didn't work out for them." And he mentions commando thing, because in 1942, I guess the commando thing, the British had been doing it, and then right. the talk of the raiders, and Vandegrift said to Holcomb, "It's this commando thing. They tried this commando thing. It didn't work out for them." And he says it in one sentence, but yeah, that it set the stage that, you know, these guys don't surrender. He's never seen fighting such as this. And then I think in conjunction with the Getchi patrol that happened on the 12th of August, mm-hmm. that these are deceitful, these Japanese, because yep. The Getchi patrol was supposed to be, we're going out to help them. And then, you know, they've deceived us. And then they killed us, you know, the deceitful people. And now they won't surrender. They trick us and try to kill us. Mm-hmm. So I think that set the stage for the rest of the Pacific War. They said, okay, yep. we'll play by your rules, even though mm-hmm. that was the rules, but that was perceived rules.
Well, it became the rules. You know, it became the rules. I mean, the Japanese didn't, or at least not very often. They did, but not
they wanted
often.
To. They didn't have a chance.
Right, right. You know, I mean, they fought to the death. You know, they fought to the last man often, not all the time, but often. And you know, there weren't any prisoners, or very few prisoners taken by the Marines or the soldiers. You know, from not just from Guadalcanal, but all the way through the war. And the Japanese did the same thing. So, I mean, the war in the Pacific was a ask no quarter, no quarter given type of thing. And this Gavutu, Tanambogo, but especially here, Tenaru, Ilu, this sets the precedent for everything that follows. And we're going to talk about, you know, obviously much more of the land campaign coming forward, you know, Edson's Ridge. The Matanikau fights, a Henderson Field fight, you know, all that stuff. And it's all, you know, just these battles of annihilation, mm-hmm. absolute battles of annihilation. Well, we could go on for a long time here.
Do we have 2 minutes? So I'll talk about Fuza.
Yeah, go for it. Yes, yes, Fuza. Yes, I forgot about Fuza. Lay it on us.
We mentioned Sir Jacob Fuza, who was the probably most famous Solomon Islander, and he's very, very famous scout. Right. Throughout the campaign. So Fuza, one quick story about Fuza involving the Battle of Alligator Creek, and you mentioned a bit about it. So Fuza, in most accounts, mm-hmm. has Fuza being, he was sent out by Clemens, who was the coast watcher, who was doing forward scouting, looking for these Japanese.
Right.
He had an American flag on him that he had actually, a Navy pilot, who was shot down, had gave him, because he brought him back to the Marine Lines, he gave him this little flag. Anyway, he's scouting around his village at Tateri. That's his own village. And the Japanese captured him from an Ichiki detachment. So he tried to put the flag, he put the flag down in his loincloth, and he had this like a pair of shorts, but they ended up finding him. Okay, they started interrogating him. They tied him to a tree. They tortured him quite a bit. They cut him, bashed him or beat him up a bit. He wouldn't disclose anything. And then the common story is at that stage, they bayoneted him and hit him with a sword and just left him. And then he's passed out and he's gained consciousness, gnawed through his ropes and run or crawl back to Marine Lines. But that's not correct. This is based on sources, especially from Martin Clemens, who was his main boss in Clemens' own story. A number of other accounts. I've spoken to Vuz's families. This is the story Fuza passed on to his family, because you know stories are very important. Sure. So that was passed on. So this is the version that they say, and what Martin Clemens says, and what Fuza is actually relayed to him. So yeah, they captured him, they tied him to a tree, they tortured him, and then they said, "You're going to take us to the Marines. You're going to guide us we need a guide. You're going to guide us." And he goes, "Okay, I'll guide you." Right. So he's guiding them down, knowing what they're about to walk into, and the first chance he's getting, he's going to try to escape. So once he's leading them down, another group had been hit, I think, with the outpost, and some fighting started, probably the outpost, the very initial, maybe in the first platoon that ran across. Anyway, they heard it shooting. They knew what was going on. So at that stage, they bayoneted him and stuck him with a sword, and the bayonet went through him. His ribs, and went into his mouth. And he's hit the ground, and then it was at night, and all the melee, he managed to crawl off and escape. Mm-hmm. He's ran down, and he's crossed roughly where the bridge is now, if you ever go to Guadalcanal. And Wilbur Brewley, I have his accounts, and my friend used to speak to him quite a bit. And Brewley was the Marine's private, the sentry, mm-hmm. that Vuzo come out of the bushes, and he challenged him. Mm-hmm. And he was about to shoot him. He goes, "You stop there, you SOB, or I'll shoot." And he goes, "Me no jap man, me Vuzo." So they end up taking him in, and Vuzo says, "Oh, look, you know," and he started giving details once they're taken to the command post, a battalion command post. He started giving details about the Japanese as much as he could. Then he started passing out from loss of blood. And then he goes, I want Clemens. And if you read Clemens' book, Clemens then comes there and speaks to Vuzo. And he goes, "Oh, I need my last will and testament." He goes, "Okay." So he started writing down. He says, "Oh, I want to leave this to so-and-so. I want to leave this to so-and-so." And he goes on and on and on. He's going, and Clemens, in his own words, says, "He might not be as bad as we think he is. Can we get this man to the hospital, to the first aid post? He's not dying." So they got him there, and they pumped him. And Vuzo to his day says he's half American because they pumped him with so much American blood. And then within 2 weeks after this, and he's 55 years old. He's retired.
That's the time this is happening.
Yeah, he's a retired Solomon Island Sergeant Major from the police. He's 55 years old. Strong, heavy man. But what he did then, after he recovered, it only took him 2 weeks. He's back on his feet. And then became the chief scout for the division. And became very super famous with the Long Patrol, Will Carlson's Long Patrol, when he led them. And Vuzo was a man you didn't trifle with. He was a killer. He would go after Japanese. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I wanted to put that
story.
In.
Some of no, it's important because, you know, and that's something that Bill and I try to do with this podcast whenever we can is, you know, as I say, there's the legends and then there's the truth to the legends. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those very instances.
And we've uncovered the myths, which,
well, yeah. Yeah. And then there's the complete myths, but, yeah. But we've uncovered quite a few of these or exposed quite a few of these for better or worse as we've gone through. And it's important, you know, it's important that people know exactly the real actual history of things and not, you know, the mm-hmm. Hollywoodized version of different things, kind of like Al Schmidt, you know. Yeah, there's several different. I know that what you're talking about. That there's several different accounts of what happened to him. Yeah, I knew guys. Whitney Jacobs was one of the H Company machine gunners who was in that hole with Al Schmidt, or rotated in and out of that hole later on. He got the Navy Cross for this action specifically. He talked about that gun being shot up full of holes. The 1917, the water jacket looked like Swiss cheese. You know, it looked like an air cooled machine gun and not a water cooled machine gun. But, yeah. So I mean, there's all kinds of different accounts, especially here, you know, in Guadalcanal, and that, you know, and I liken this back to earlier parts of the Pacific Wars that, you know, we needed heroes, you know, for better or worse. We being the United States Republic, we needed heroes. We needed the stories that were gonna get people to want to enlist in the United States Marine Corps, get people to want to go fight and kill Japanese. And these are the kind of stories that did that very thing. Oh, well, no Dave, problem. I know I speak for Bill. We'd love to have you back on if you'd be willing to join us. You know, we got some more land battles we want to talk about, not the least of which is Edson's Ridge. You know,
yeah, I'm always happy to talk about Guadalcanal. As you know, I could probably talk all day.
Well, let's do it again, man. Let's do it again soon.
Yeah, I'm happy.
I want to read a little closer here, and this comes from the 1st Marine Division report on the Tulagi operation, and it goes like this. It says, quote, "The combat," and this is, you know, all-encompassing for the rest of Guadalcanal here. "The combat assumed the nature of a storming operation from the outset, a soldier's battle, unremitting and relentless, to be decided only by the extermination of one or the other of the adversaries engaged. And this will come to play for the next several months, anytime the Americans engage the Japanese on Guadalcanal." So, and with that, I want to thank you. We want to thank you for being a part of our conversation, for listening in and listening to what we had to say. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast wherever you receive your podcasts and give us a rating and review. We would definitely, definitely appreciate it. Also, if you want to see the video version of this and any of our other episodes, subscribe to our YouTube channel called The Unauthorized History of the Pacific War Podcast. Also, look us up on Facebook, like and subscribe to our page there as well. Also, look up Dave's page. Dave, give us the rundown on your page real quick. Your Guadalcanal page?
Yeah, I've got two pages. I've got YouTube, Guadalcanal Walking the Battlefield. which is 49 videos now. Most of them are walking you through, like I'm giving you a personal tour. And they also have a Facebook Guadalcanal Walking a Battlefield, which I update every 2 or 3 days. With hopefully, I try to put fresh material that no one's ever seen about Guadalcanal on there. So those two sites.
I've seen a lot of images of Guadalcanal and a lot of the pictures that Dave puts up on his Facebook page. I've never seen before, if I have seen them before, the context that's in those images is outstanding. I could not recommend it highly.
Absolutely, I love your video on Barcelona. Where it really all was,
of,
right?
All yeah, of them. They're
in
all
fact, very, it's very the 80th anniversary today. By the way,
it is.
That's right.
Holy cow!
24th, 25th. And it's the 25th here, so it's real time.
Right.
Yes, 24th here.
Wow. I had no idea.
Yep. Well, again, if you have a question, comment, or suggestion, please send us an email at unauthorizedspecificpodcast@gmail.com. So once again, my name is Seth Parrott, and I want to say thank you very much, Bill.
And I'm Bill Todi. Thank you for joining us.
Dave, thank you for being with us, and we want to see you again, man. Appreciate it.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks again, guys.
All right. Thank you, guys. And we'll see you all next week.